We have this way of going at life that we kind of think that, boy, there's always going to be somebody to bail us out, somebody to bail us out, somebody to bail us out. And sometimes the truth is we just have to own up to the fact that things didn't go the way we wanted them to. And that's hard. But this particular season of Thanksgiving really isn't about the turkey. And as much as we have come to love having family together and all the things that happen when you have family together, many of them good, some of them a little annoying, when all of that is going on, we have to really stop and remember that what this particular holiday was about was recognizing that we are a blessed people. That those blessings are not the result of our hard work. They're not the result of our brilliant plans. They're the result of the grace of a God who chose to be merciful to us. I hear people sometimes talk about how much they have done. And yet, you know, who decided where you were born? And in what environment you would grow up? Who invested you with your skills, your intelligence, your particular grouping of abilities and passions? We don't come into this world blank slates in spite of what was once thought. We come into this world with a creator who has made us who we are. And we have a chance once in a while to just stop and say thanks. And that's what we're going to be doing this particular week. And I hope that you all, in that time, really do take a moment to just reflect on the fact of the blessings that God has brought into your life. To help us do that, we are going to have a service on Wednesday night. It's going to be different than the services we've done in the past. Over the years, we've gotten into the routine of kind of doing a family craft activity and then sharing some pie and having what we called pie and praise. And we realized that over time, we were not really mingling and not really focusing maybe on the praise and on the experience as much as we wanted to. So we're going to do things a little different this year. If you've seen the flyer that's gone out, and I hope you have, by the way, you should have gotten one in the mail, or if not, there should be some around for you to pick up that give a sense of the services coming up this season. We've got some great things happening here over the next couple of months, but this coming Wednesday, we're having our Thanksgiving service. We've kind of split the words that way on purpose. We want to look at how we serve others, and so we're going to do a couple of things to help with that. There still will be a little craft for the kids to do, so that the kids who come with you as families will not just be sitting here, you know, listening. They'll have a chance to do a little something. But what we really are going to do is take a moment and focus on the blessings we've received and how we encourage one another with that. Then we're going to have just a little project that will get us focused on those outside of our walls and how we serve them. And then we're going to have some cookies. And this year, you don't have to bring a pie. So if you're the person who says, well, I don't bake pies, and I didn't come because I didn't want to come empty-handed, and I know people were there sharing their pies, and okay, well, then don't worry about it. We're not going to do the pie thing. We're going to have some cookies. The church is going to provide them. We'll have something to drink with those cookies. We'll have a little time. And we'll just fellowship together after our study and after our little experience, and we'll have a chance to hopefully mingle and encourage one another. And I know it's a time when sometimes family members who've been gone for a while come home, and they get a chance to meet and share again. So good time, Wednesday night, 7 o'clock here for Thanksgiving Eve. And then we start getting into all of the events. We get into the Christmas musical and the children's musical and Gifts to Christ and Christmas Day celebrations and Christmas Eve, and all those things are unfolding now, beginning real quickly. The one thing I also want to comment on in that regard is next week we'll be introducing our Gifts to Christ projects. And for those who know Washington Heights, you know this is a very special time in our year. For those who don't know, I want to introduce you to one of the best things we do here at Washington Heights. And that's every Christmas season, we take a very special offering. We've identified projects both here at home and internationally in our missions programs that are projects that aren't going to get done any other way except through the special support of God's people. And we have taken the attitude that says, at this season of the year, shouldn't we focus to give as much to Jesus and his work as we do to the people around us in all the gift giving that the world would have us commercialized into? So we always say put Jesus at the top of your Christmas list. And if you were to give as much to him as you gave to the next person on that list, that you know, top gift kind of person, think what we could do in accomplishing things for Christ. So we put Jesus on the top of our Christmas list, and we collect our gifts to Christ every year the week before Christmas. This year it'll be on Sunday the 18th. That'll be the same day as our children's musical. So just some neat things going on that Sunday, and we hope you'll be here. And start planning now for our Gifts to Christ offering. And we'll give you the project starting next week, and over the next several weeks, we'll be introducing a couple of different projects each week so you know the things that we'll be supporting together as a church family through that offering. Really neat times, really good things happening here at our church. But coming back to this idea of Thanksgiving and the things that we come to realize in our blessings and how we give thanks for them, one of the more outstanding passages that we see is in the book of Luke. And I would ask you to take your copy of God's Word and turn there or scroll there or search there or whatever you need to do, but find your way to Luke chapter 17. We've been looking at some Thanksgiving topics the last couple of weeks. We looked at the idea of being thankful for sin. And I know that sounds like a strange thing, but thankful that God really has not judged sin yet, but let sin run so that there is the opportunity still for people who do not know Christ to come to him and have their sins forgiven and find the hope of eternity and the power of the resurrection in Jesus. And that it is a blessing and an opportunity for each of us. And we commented that if each of us as believers would just encounter six people who don't know Jesus and share his love and his truth with them, and they were to follow him, we could literally win our entire nation. It just takes us reaching out. And so that was one thing. Be thankful for the opportunities God has given us. Last week we took a little look at the opportunity to really worship. And what it means to come with hearts that are just filled to the point of shouting and of we talked about the fact of even like a cheerleader, just, you know, really letting the cheers go up for Christ and knowing what it is to gather as his people and to see that as a blessing as we come together in praise and thanksgiving. And today I want to talk just a little bit about this idea of giving thanks. And I came across an article by a man named Chris Rapizzi. I don't actually know him. It was in a publication I get called Preaching Today, one of the things that Christianity Today publishes for ministry people. And he talked about not being thanksgiving, but being thanksgivers. I thought that was just a great little title, a great little way to approach it, learning to be thanksgivers. And I had been looking at this passage already, and it just kind of hit me that that's what we have here. We have the idea of someone who becomes a thanksgiver. Now, many of us know this passage. It's one that has been referred to often. It's kind of a favorite, maybe the second or third most often referred to passage at Thanksgiving time. But it's the story of Jesus coming to a village and encountering there 10 diseased individuals, 10 lepers, and what happened. So we begin reading in verse 11. It says, on the way to Jerusalem, he was passing along between Samaria and Galilee. And as he entered a village, he was met by 10 lepers who stood at a distance and lifted up their voices, saying, Jesus, Master, have mercy on us. And when he saw them, he said to them, go, show yourselves to the priests. And as they went, they were cleansed. Then one of them, when he saw that he was healed, turned back, praising God with a loud voice, and he fell on his face at Jesus' feet, giving him thanks. Now, he was a Samaritan. Then Jesus answered, were not 10 cleansed? Where are the 9? Was no one found to return and give praise to God except this foreigner? And he said to him, rise and go on your way. Your faith has made you well. The point of this particular story, and it's not listed as a parable, it's actually told as if it was a real event, and the point of this particular story of Jesus' ministry is pretty obvious. You know, only one came back and gave thanks. And so we look around, we say, are we the 9 or are we the 1? Are we the ones who take our blessings and just go on almost like we deserved it? Or are we the one who comes back and gives thanks? And there's the challenge, and you say, well, boy, that was good, Dave. I've never seen you get a message done in 2 minutes. And you know, if that's what you take away, if you take away nothing today other than that, I want to be the one who gives thanks. Hey, I am cool with that. That's a great message. So, you know, you can get your nap now or whatever, and that'll be a good day. But I think there's more in this passage that we can study and learn. And so I want to take just a few minutes and talk a little bit more about what's here. And it starts with the attitude of Jesus. It starts with the attitude of Jesus. Because you know what I see immediately here is I see Jesus not hesitating to meet their need. And I know that this is complicated in our world today, but I also know that many of us find that we are hesitant, really, to reach out and meet people's needs. And there are a lot of reasons why, especially strangers. We don't know if they really need it or not. And we don't know if we're being taken advantage of, and we don't want to be people who are taken advantage of. And then there's just timidity, you know, how's this person going to respond to me? And I don't really know them. And you know, I'm not sure that I have the resources that they need. And, you know, and we get very, very cautious. And I'm not even saying that there isn't reason for that caution. We live in a very broken world, and we live in a world where bad things happen to good people, and we live in a world where encounters aren't always what they seem to be. And some of us have, you know, gotten over time burned by an encounter with someone in need. And so we do become very, very cautious about the idea of reaching out. But I want to encourage you that is why we're here. I really want to encourage you that is why we're here. When Jesus ascended into heaven, he said, "And you will be my witnesses." And we understand that as people who are following Jesus, this world is not our home, as the old song used to say. We're just a passing through. Our treasures are laid up somewhere beyond the blue. And if we really believe that old song or that old poem, and that idea that we're not working to invest in this life, then protecting what this life has should not be our highest priority. I'm not saying we go out and suddenly be just, you know, foolish and stupid about things, but I am saying we need to be much less cautious and much more willing, much more open and active to looking at the opportunities that God brings into our path. I'm not saying you have to go and solve every problem there is in the world. But when God brings an opportunity into your path, are you open and willing to making the effort to reach out and try to invest in that particular individual, that particular need? Because the thing I see here, first of all, is that Jesus just opened up in his kindness, opened up in his love, opened up in his heart, and met the need that was in front of him. And he did it, as we would say in our age, without discrimination. He didn't stop and say, "Now, okay, which one of you are Jews, and did you all attend synagogue this week, and, you know, can you show me your attendance records, and by the way, do any of you have any problems with the Roman government or with the Jewish administrators here, and because, you know, I'm not going to help somebody, I'm not going to enable somebody, you know, so let me get your qualifications. Here's an application. I've got an app for all 10 of you. Will you please fill out the app, and I'll take it under advisement, and we'll see if you meet our qualifications for assistance." Now, I say that, and I'll tell you, here at the church, we actually do have an application. We found that we need some way of just getting a relationship started with these people who sometimes come to us in need. And there is, you know, a world out there that is bent on scamming sometimes. And so you have to kind of be a little careful. So we do have an application. But I also want to tell you, the application isn't really the thing. That's more of a way to get a contact and open some doors of communication and really getting to know these people a little bit. But Jesus didn't do that. He just met their need. And it is a challenge for us, I think, to be open to let Jesus work through us to meet the needs. You say, well yeah, but people aren't always receptive. That's exactly right. And that's where I think the story takes a twist that we forget. We always focus on the one who came back. Isn't that great? The one came back. 9 went away, and Jesus let him go. 9 went away, and Jesus let them go. You know, we're going to go out there and we're going to give. We're going to reach out to people. We're going to offer the gospel. We're going to try to work in their lives. We're going to be loving, supporting. We're going to do those random acts of kindness. We're going to do those things. And you know what? Not everybody's going to respond. In fact, most people probably won't respond. Most people probably won't respond. You say, does that make us a failure? Does that make what we did unworthy? Does that mean we wasted it because we gave to people who took it and ran away and weren't grateful and didn't respond and didn't care? I don't think so. Because, you see, it's not about that effectiveness. That's in God's hands. We remember that it is the Spirit who convicts and convinces. It is the Spirit of God who calls people to himself. We were not called to be producers. We were called to be witnesses. And we really get that wrong sometimes. God never said, when you stand before me, I am going to quiz you about your production. Now, I've had preachers who sometimes lay that out like a guilt, responsibility on people. Oh, you're going to stand before God, and if you didn't win people to Christ. I have never understood in my study of Scripture and theology that I was the one who did the, quote, winning. That was the Spirit of God. But I was the one who did the witnessing. And I needed to be effective in my witness. I needed to be wise in my witness. I needed to be intentional and purposeful in my witness. And then allow the Spirit of God to take that witness and use it as he will in the lives of people. That's what I see Jesus doing here. That's interesting as we look at it to see that these ten, they knew who Jesus was. The place we are in the life of Jesus is that he and the disciples are moving towards Jerusalem in that final phase of his ministry. When he gets to Jerusalem for the Passover at the end of this particular section that Luke is unfolding here, we believe that that's when he's going to have the time with the Lord's table, and then he'll, the triumphant entry and the time with the Lord's table and eventually Calvary and all. That's the Passover that's coming, is that Lord's table Passover. That's where he's headed. He's on his way up to Jerusalem. And he's between Samaria and Galilee. And so that's, as we would look at a map, that's between the north and the south. He's moving from the north up by the Sea of Galilee, and he's moving down towards Jerusalem. It's actually uphill, but it's south on our map. And he's going through these villages along the way. And these villages were villages along what was a pilgrim's path. The pilgrimages were made every year, sometimes two and three times a year. If somebody made all the big feasts to Jerusalem, they would be going for this trip up to Jerusalem, uphill to Jerusalem, probably three times a year, and they'd spend about a week there. Then they'd go back and take care of their business at home. And so these pathways through these villages were well known. They were well marked, and it was common to have beggars along the way. Now, in this particular instance, we have these people who were marked out as leprosy. And I'll be very frank, we don't know if it was the exact leprosy disease that we have defined in our medical books today. We know it was some kind of a contagious, visible skin disease. That would be what would be classified. And it made people in that culture what they would say was unclean. And that was a way of saying that you don't want to get near me, what I've got can spread. What I've got could be contagious. And so it isolated people from their families. It isolated people from their careers. It isolated people from their communities. We did this for literally hundreds of years. I remember back in the 70s, I had a chance to be in the area of the Amazon in Brazil, just near the city of Manaus. Some of you may remember from the World Cup down there a couple of years ago, a city of Manaus up in the Amazon, right along the Amazon. There were a lot of, pictures, aerial photographs, the blimp and all that during the World Cup. Well, just north of the city of Manaus, out in the rainforest of the Amazon, there was a leper colony. And I remember I only went out there when I was a student at Cedarville, and actually it was when I was working for Cedarville, and we had a chance to go down there. And I remember going into that leper colony. All these people had the disease, and they were all now kept isolated so that there would not be any contagion. And I have to tell you, it was probably the cleanest village I have ever been in, and I've been in places all over the world. I mean, because of the nature of the disease, they kept everything truly antiseptic, and because of the potential for damage, everything was like rounded corners and well-marked and, you know, clean, bright paint. It was just a, it was actually really a very beautiful place out in the middle of the rainforest. It was lovely. I remember we went there, and they didn't get a lot of visitors. They didn't get a lot of outside visitors. We went there and we did our programs. We had some puppet programs for the kids, and we had some musical programs, and we had some speaking programs, and we all did our thing. And I remember getting done, and them gathering around us, and thanking us, and of course, they had been taught not to shake hands, not to, you know. So there was a just this barrier. I thought, how awkward. How awkward that, you know, you always had to be conscious of maintaining a barrier to another human being. And that's the way these people had lived their lives, unclean, unclean. And yet they had heard that there was this man, Jesus, coming. And at this time in the life of Jesus, we believe that probably the message had gone out that he was a healer, that he had encountered other people with physical ailments and had done miraculous things, healing people who couldn't walk or healing people who were born blind. I wonder how long they were waiting, hoping he might come on this pilgrimage with his disciples and those who followed him. But as we look at the text, it says, on the way to Jerusalem, passing between Samaria and Galilee, he entered the village and he was met by 10 lepers who stood at a distance, that barrier. And they said, Jesus. They knew who he was. And they said, Master, Rabbi, Teacher, have pity on us. Have mercy on us. Feel sorry for us, but help us. And it says that Jesus simply said, go show yourselves to the priests. Now, we hear that, and that sounds a little awkward. Go show yourselves to the priests. Well, remember, the priests were the ones who were the mitigators, if you will. They were the keepers of the law, and the law is what prescribed that someone with this disease should be separated so the rest of the tribe, the rest of the village, the rest of the people were not infected. And so there were doctors. Luke himself was a doctor. I'm sure he found this story fascinating, you know, as a medical person of his day. But, you know, Jesus didn't say, oh, come here and let's see how your faith is and come here and let's hear. He just said, go and show yourself to the priest. And they all knew what that meant because it was the priest who was the one who said whether you were healed or not and said whether you could go back into your family, back into your career, back into society, back into normal life. Now, here's the part I find very interesting about this story when we start, you know, ragging on those 9 guys who didn't say thank you. We kind of look at them like, boy, you know, how could they be like that? Very fascinating way the text is structured in what it says. It says, as they went, as they were going, meaning after they turned around and left, while they were on their way, Jesus said, go show yourselves to the priest, and they took off to show themselves to the priest. And as they were going, it says, they were cleansed. Now, you know, I don't know what that was like. I know this. It's not what I would have expected. If I'd have been there and I had a skin disease that was visible to all, and I said, Jesus, Master, have pity on me, I'd be standing there waiting for him to do something. Come and rub mud on my eyes like he did for the blind man, or come and lay a hand on me, or say some, you know, incantational word. Come and hit me in the forehead and say, be healed. Heal, whatever it is. That's what I'd be with. Wouldn't you? I mean, wouldn't you want Jesus to do something to take care of your problem? And all he says is, well, go show yourselves to the priests. And I'd be going, like this? You didn't do anything, Jesus. If I go show myself to the priest like this, he's just going to laugh at me and say, why are you here? Go back. Get away from me. You know, you're infected. What I notice is they all went. What I notice is they all went. At some level, they all believed Jesus, all 10 of them. At some level, wouldn't we call that faith? That they all took off and went towards the priest as soon as Jesus said to? And they were all healed. Every one of them was healed. Do you think that the other 9 were somehow not grateful? Suppose you acted on what Jesus said and you took off and you went to the priest or you went to the doctor or you went to the, you know, whatever the agency was. Let's say they had a, you know, a branch of the Centers for Disease Control that was responsible for this and you had to show up and be tested. And so you went and you got there and they gave you the clean bill of health. They said, hey, you know, no problem here. All tests negative. You're free to go. And you now had the privilege to go back and hug your wife or your kids for the first time in who knows how long. You had a chance to go back and reapply for your job and say, hey, you know, I'm here. I'm good. I can work again. You could go back to your own home and not be in the leper colony or whatever it was. And you knew that you had been standing by the roadside and said, Jesus, have pity on us. Do you really think that those guys all went, oh, man, look at me. Man, I beat this disease. It was that regimen of hummus and falafel that I had, you know, over in. I know it was that new exercise program I got into. No. I actually think they were probably pretty happy. I think they were probably pretty grateful. The difference is they just didn't do anything about it. They got caught up in their own lives again, their own wonderful, good, restored, amazing, given back to them after having been taken away from them lives again. They got just so busy. I'm not going to ask you to raise your hands, but how many of you would say your life is really busy? And I'm not making fun. I don't know anybody anymore that I meet who just isn't, oh, I'm so busy. There's just so much going on. Yeah, got this at work and got this with the kids and got this with the, and now it's Thanksgiving week and we're just all so busy. Too busy to be thankful for the blessings that we've received. Oh, we're grateful for them. We are. We're thankful for our jobs and we're glad for our family. And you know, but we don't have time to stop and do anything about it because we've got to get on to the next thing, you know? It's busy. That's what I see that's amazing here. It's not that the 10 lepers didn't act in faith. They all did. It's not that the 9 of them probably, I can't say it specifically from the next, probably weren't grateful. I have to believe they were normal, you know, typical human beings who had been, you know, in this outcast position for who knows how long, maybe years, maybe decades, and suddenly, suddenly they're brought back in with their families. And they're, I mean, I really believe that they were very, very thankful for what had happened to them, but they just were so busy getting on with life. And then I realized something. Being grateful, having a thankful attitude, that's an emotion. That's something I feel. That's something I'm. But giving thanks, that's intentional. And that's an action. That's work. And I'm going to suggest to you that what's really happening here is about the intentionality of the one, not just his thankfulness. I think all 10 were thankful, but one was intentional to do something about his thankfulness. He was intentional to turn around and go back and find Jesus and give thanks, not just to Jesus, but to God. My mom was born on June 12th of 1924. Okay, that's nothing special. June 12th, 1924. But there was another person who was born on that day, another part of the country. She was born in Illinois. He was born somewhere, I believe, out east. No, I take that back. I don't actually know. I forget now. But that person, that other person who was born on June 12th of 1924, went on to become quite prominent. He became the 41st president of the United States, George Herbert Walker Bush, George H.W. Bush, born the same day as my mom. Not just the date, same day. Now, I don't know what caused mom to do that, but in early June of 1991, while President and Mrs. Bush were in the office, in the White House, my mom wrote the president a note. You know, she got out her stationery. My mom liked stationery. She was that old world kind of person. She actually had really good handwriting, really nice, pretty handwriting, and she enjoyed writing those notes. And so she got her stationery out and she got a piece and she wrote the president a note. And it just said, "Happy birthday. We share the same birthday, not just date. Those of us who've been around for as long as we have need to stick together." And wished he and Barbara, you know, all success in the coming year. And she put it in, well, she mailed it to the White House. Now, I'm pretty bold. I'm like, you know, people don't usually look at me and see a wallflower, but I've never written the president, you know, partly because I figure it'll just wind up in a trash bin somewhere. But my mom took her hand and wrote the president. Well, what was amazing is about a week later, we get this note back. Seal the White House on it. It says, you know, the White House, Washington. You notice that the White House doesn't need any other address? It doesn't say, like, the White House, 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. It just says, the White House, Washington. Like, okay, that's cool. It says, "Dear Mrs. Kistner, I'm pleased to know that we share the same birthday. I hope that June 12th is a special day for you and that the coming year will be one of both improved health and much happiness. Barbara joins me in sending her best wishes to you. Sincerely, now, I don't know if it's real or not. Maybe some staffer, you know, like 12th level down in the basement of the administrative wing of the building signed it. I don't know. They have this thing I know called an auto pen that, you know, they've taken the president's signature and then the auto pen traced it and then it becomes a computer program and then they've got like 9 of these pens in a row and the paper just comes in and it gets auto penned. I know that happens. I don't know for sure whether that's it or not, but this is one thing I do know, and it's why I have some hope that, you know, maybe, just maybe it's authentic, is that George H.W. Bush was known to be a man who, in the first hour of his official schedule every day, signed notes to constituents. Had done it since he was a congressman. Every morning, he had his staff bring in a stack of responses to constituents. Did it all through his presidency. And he spent an hour looking at the notes and signing the responses. He did that every day. When asked about it one time, he said, "I never want to forget people that I serve." If you've ever listened to the stories of the various presidents and how they get along with the White House staff, the permanent staff, the cleaning staff and the maintenance staff and the gardening staff and the cooking staff, the people who are there, you know, they say, presidents come and go, the staff are there forever. You hear about the presidents who the staff don't get along with, who are arrogant and distant and even sometimes mean. And then you hear about the staff who are kind and supportive and gracious, you know. The Carters were known to be a wonderful first family. Both the president and Rosalind were known to be gracious with the staff and know their names and interact well with them. And George and Barbara Bush were known to be the same way. One time, the story goes that President George H.W. Bush was going between the residence and the West Wing, and there's a corridor along there, and one of the gardeners was there, and the gardener just was moving slowly and just wasn't real involved. The president stopped, and he knew him by name. He said, are you okay today? And he, Mr. President, he goes, well, you've been around here, and you don't look like you're doing well. He goes, it's nothing. He said, we had to put my dog down last night. And if you know the president at that time, he had a couple of, I think they were terriers, two black terriers, I think is what he had. So he told the Secret Service to take that man and let him have the rest of the day off. And he took the two terriers and said, let him go out in the yard, White House, let him go out in the yard and just play with the dogs for a while. It might make him feel better. Why am I telling you these stories? If there's anybody in the world who can use the excuse, I'm busy today, it's the president. I have a feeling that none of us have his schedule. And yet this president, George H.W. Bush, believed in being intentional about thanking little old ladies in Wisconsin who would write him notes. The story goes on, and it's pointed out that he was a Samaritan. We could spend a long time on that. Samaritans were the outcasts. They were the half-breeds among the pure tribes of Judaism. They were hated and despised. They had their own place of worship. All kinds of things made Samaritans the really bad people of their day. It was the Samaritan who came back. And when he came back, Jesus simply says, we're not 10 healed, where are the 9? Was no one found to return and give praise? Notice he doesn't say, was no one found to come back and be thankful? Like I said, I think they were all thankful. He goes, was no one found to come back and give praise to God except for this foreigner? And then he said to him, rise and go your way. Your faith has made you well. The term there that we translate well is the same term that we could translate as saved. Some actual translations put in there, your faith has saved you. Now, nobody wants to quite get into, was that, like eternal salvation, or is that just referring to his physical condition? And so they translate it as made you well, and, it's kind of one of those things we don't know. But what I find interesting, it says your faith has saved you. Now, just a minute, let me think about it. The other 9 acted on what Jesus said. That took some degree of faith, didn't it? The other 9 were all healed. So it's not like they suddenly got sick again. We don't have any indication of that. It's not like he got a healing the others didn't get. What was Jesus saying? Your faith has made you well. Your faith has saved you. I think that there are levels, frankly, if you want to put it in this story of faith. I think that all 10 believed that Jesus had the power to heal their physical bodies. But I think only one had the heart to acknowledge Jesus as his master and his Lord. Only one came back and bowed down and praised God with a loud voice, falling on his face and giving thanks. There's a difference between believing that God can help you and believing that God is your God. Do you know that? There's a difference between believing that God has blessed you and that you live in a blessed land or that you have, and believing that God, that Jesus, is your Lord and your Master. And this foreigner, this Samaritan, this one who didn't know anything about the prophecies, he was the one who knew, yes, I'm blessed. And yes, Jesus healed me. But there's more to it than that. And he came back and he gave praise to God and he thanked Jesus. Interesting, there's actually two things. He came back praising God with a loud voice, and then he fell at his face at Jesus' feet and gave him thanks. They're not actually the exact same thing. He thanked Jesus and he praised God. As we go through our lives, a couple of lessons I see. One, we need to have the same heart of Jesus for reaching out to meet the needs of others. Two, we have to know that meeting their physical needs is not the end of the story. We want to see them spiritually come to Christ as well. Number three, we're not going to win everybody we witness to. That's okay. Because God is going to take our witness and he's going to apply it effectively to somebody's life. The measure is how much we share. And number four, it's not just about having a sense of being happy or thankful for what we've had. It's about intentionally taking the step to give praise to God and thanks to those around us. So here's some practical things I want to suggest that you do over the next couple days to become better thanksgivers. I want to suggest that, number one, you be specific. Don't just say, oh, honey, thank you. Say thank you for whatever it is that your wife or your spouse does. Say thank you for working hard every day to bring home the paycheck. Say thank you for taking care of the garage or taking out the garbage or you know, fixing the meal, you know, planning the menu every day or for, be specific. Say thank you for, I noticed you did that. I bet it took you some time to organize the cabinets so that, you know, all the spices were in alphabetical order. That was work. Thank you for doing that. I can find the cinnamon when I want it. Be specific. Number two, reach out to the neighbors, the uncomfortable ones, the ones who you don't meet every day and maybe who you aren't even always that comfortable with, and find some reason to thank them and acknowledge them and let them know that you appreciate them. But you have to be honest. You see, you need to be specific, and you need to be honest. People see through inauthenticity in a moment. And then I think you need to be public about it. When it's appropriate. When it's appropriate. I don't mean you put a big sign in your yard that says, thank you, neighbor, for, oh, maybe that'd be cool, I don't know. But I do mean that you don't keep it just all so very, very quiet. When it's appropriate and you're there and you're talking to the neighbor down the street, you say, hey, you know, Joe next door, do you know what he did for me? He came over and he blew my leaves for me. He had his blower out and he was blowing. He came over and blew. Wow. So, you know, I mean, what a nice guy he is. Have you met Joe down the street? Don't just keep it to yourself. And that goes for here in our fellowship as well. Share the good news about one another in the body of Christ. And then I think that there's a time to do what my mom did, a time to do what the president or his staff did. There's a time to put it down in writing. There's a time to take the people around you and make it permanent, not just passing, not just a comment. There's a time to write to your family, your workmates, your neighbors, the members of your church. There's time to say, I just wanted to thank you for teaching my kids in the Sunday school, being there in Awana, spending your Saturdays in January and February coaching upward or reffing upward. Or, you know, and you need to send those notes out. Send them a text. Send them an email. God be praised. Actually get out the stationery like my mom did and a pen and write it down. Of all the things I know that connect people, having an honest statement of thanksgiving, one person to another, builds a bond that is just amazing because we don't expect it. We really don't expect it. And when someone stops and thanks you for what you've done, it's like, oh. And you know what's really, how do you say thank you to a thank you? You know? Thank you. Well, thank you. Well, thank you. Thank you for thanking me. Well, thank you for thanking me for thanking you. And now, when somebody says thank you, you just kind of got to take it and go, okay, wow. But you know what happens then? Because now you've got a bond to them. Now you're connected to them. So, this Thanksgiving, number one, praise God. Number two, thank one another. And be intentional about recognizing the blessings we have. Father, thank you so much for our time around this word and this amazing story and the way that you, in your love, showed us the path even as you dealt with these lepers. And Lord, we pray that our faith, our real faith, will cause us not just to be grateful for what we've received in this life, but will cause us to praise you and be your witnesses to a world that has not yet met you. Until all have heard and all have come to follow you as Lord. We ask this in Jesus' name.